Hello and welcome to Off the Books, where we surf the uncharted waters of accounting, finance, risk, and wherever else the waves take us. This episode is brought to you by Workiva, the platform that brings financial reporting, ESG audit, and risk teams together to help you provide assured integrated reporting. That's just not something you see every day, like an SEC proposal that doesn't get any comments or a total eclipse. My name is Steve Soder, accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado, looking forward to debiting a great conversation, and I'm so happy to have you along with us. Catherine, could you introduce yourself?
Sure, I'm Catherine Tsai. I'm not an accountant or Diet Coke aficionado, but I like asking questions and learning new things, and so I'm really happy to have our guests here today. Members of SEC reporting teams or the SEC professionals group probably already know him. He's a former regional director of the SEC, former associate director of enforcement, and currently he's a partner at the law firm Jones Day. So please welcome to the podcast, David Peevler. David, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I really appreciate it.
And we know you're a busy person, so we're going to try to keep it tight to just a couple of questions. One of the questions that we'll ask you is about the court challenges to the SEC climate-related disclosure rule. But first, we have a question that's inspired by recent events.
Yeah, David, we see regular stories of executives who get accused of some kind of wrongdoing with some kind of finance-related matter, and maybe that's specific to finance, maybe that's disclosure, and their defense often seems to be, hey, I couldn't have possibly been expected to understand what the accountants were doing, or that's way too much in the weeds. Assuming that you're a public company, our question is, how much can a CEO, or an executive for that matter, reasonably be expected to know and rely on a defense that's like, hey, that's way too much in the weeds, that's just out of the remit of my job?
Well, and I think, Steve, in every one of those cases that you're talking about, they're really fact-specific because there's no one-size-fits-all for any public company. The theory that you're talking about, though, is precisely what drove some of the changes in law after the Enron and WorldCom cases earlier this century that prompted Sarbanes-Oxley and prompted the need to have certifications, the Sarbanes-Oxley certifications, which spawned a whole process below that of sub-certifications. But I think when you think about the complexity of a lot of organizations, it's not unreasonable for a CEO or a CFO who has signed a certification and has followed a process that is reasonably designed to say, I followed the rules. I followed the process. I don't know everything that's in my company. And so I think from that standpoint, it is a reasonable approach. Where I think executives have gotten into trouble is where they did know of, you know, of red flags, where they did know that there were issues, and notwithstanding what may have been in the sub-certifications, their own knowledge, the own things that were brought to their attention kind of supersedes that process. But again, I think for most organizations, There, you almost have to be able to rely on your internal controls, processes over financial reporting, over your disclosure controls. Otherwise, you know, frankly, you would just be kind of an open-ended responsibility.
And if I was to think about a really ridiculous example where I've signed many, many sub-certifications in my career, and of course our CFO and others are relying on those sub-certifications. If I take a ridiculous example and say, well, the CFO is looking to Steve, Steve signs a sub-certification, but I'm looking to my reporting manager who was supposed to have done something. They then look to the staff accountant or the intern who was supposed to have, you know, checked this thing or whatever, and suddenly you have this like, well, it was actually the CFO that's ultimately relying on the work of an intern. Again, this is a completely ridiculous example. I'm guessing that in that case, it's not so much that it was unreasonable for a CFO to rely on that. You actually had a process problem. You actually had an internal control issue simply because the process itself didn't have those checks and balances along the way. And I just bring that up because to me that seems ridiculous, but maybe happens more often than we might like to think.
And I think that's a good observation is, while that scenario may be a little bit out there, it's the SEC has started thinking about and looking at and even bringing cases built on the quality of the control process, the disclosure controls and procedures themselves. So in other words, you can have a situation where, yes, there is a sub-certification process. There is a disclosure committee. But if the design of the controls that are designed to bring information to those responsible for making disclosure decisions is flawed, then that is a place where the SEC has been active in the last couple of years. And so even if maybe you don't have fraud, you don't have a misrepresentation, you don't have a false statement, but you have a flawed procedure, the SEC can step in and either hold the company responsible, which is where they've been to this point, but in at least theoretically could also hold the certifying executives responsible for those flawed procedures.
Well, if I could take it into an even more ridiculous realm, Steve and I have talked a little bit about the situation at University of Michigan, Jim Harbaugh, and also Connor Stallions. And you also mentioned red flags. So what sort of obligation is there on the C-suite, maybe if they don't necessarily see a red flag, but to ask questions like, how come we're doing so well in this particular game? How are we able to anticipate what this other team is doing? You know, what questions should CEOs be asking even if they don't see a red flag right in their face?
Again, that's a tough one to answer categorically, but I think what you typically see, what I saw when I was at the SEC, is when you have information that doesn't really add up. Just taking the Michigan example, if you see a pattern that suggests that there is something going on that doesn't make sense, and you don't ask the question, and you don't, you know, do the additional step of, does this really add up, then I think it is opening up the risk. Now, obviously, the SEC doesn't have jurisdiction over the University of Michigan football program, but if you translated that to a public company, almost no fraud case, you know, a disclosure fraud or accounting fraud case leaves a trail of, you know, the fraud memo where somebody says, I did this. And so it's always drawn or built from circumstantial evidence. Just take an example that is sort of real world. The SEC brought a number of cases in its earnings per share initiative where they looked at companies who were remarkably consistent in their performance on meeting earnings per share targets. And in a number of those cases, they brought charges for fraud and misrepresentation. And if you're, say, an executive and you're looking at this and say, well, gosh, you know, we have hit our targets 27 quarters in a row. And I know that we have had ups and downs. I know our competitors haven't. I know that the economy or the broader market is going in a different direction. How have we done that? And you start looking and seeing diving catches. You maybe had a meeting towards the end of a quarter where, gosh, we're really short. And then you get to the end of the quarter and we've made it, you know, just by the skin of our teeth. Those are the kinds of circumstantial pieces of information that a regulator or a law enforcement agency may say prompts a duty to drill down below your certifications, drill down below what someone else may be telling you. Now, that creates complications, you know, the kind of cabining of information that you see in large companies has created issues for regulators and law enforcement. Maybe one of the reasons there weren't many cases that came out of the financial crisis 15 years ago is because information was kind of cabin throughout these very large financial institutions. But that is how I would have looked at it as a regulator.
Would you say that then a good practice for a CFO who says, boy, you know, 27 quarters in a row, we just always seem to make the number. Do you think a good practice is to actually document, hey, I had that very same question. This seemed really weird. I asked these questions. These were the answers that I got. Those answers appeared reasonable based on everything that I knew. I mean, is that enough so that in case that actually does go to an enforcement action or there's some kind of fraud or whatever, at least the CFO could say, hey, look, I saw the same thing. I asked these same questions. The answers seem reasonable. Shouldn't that be enough, you know, at least for me not to be culpable?
And I think that's exactly right, Steve. You know, the agencies that govern public companies, govern financial services companies, aren't asking you to be prescient. You're not expected to have a crystal ball and understand everything, but they also expect you as a senior executive to use the wisdom, to use the knowledge and the experience that you have to identify issues and to ask questions on those issues. And maybe your process doesn't uncover whatever the problem is. But as long as you have followed the process and asked those questions, I think it makes it very hard, maybe not impossible, but certainly makes it very hard for someone to come back with 2020 hindsight and say that you did something intentionally wrong, or kind of equally that you were intentionally ignorant of information.
What about for private companies?
Well, it, that probably depends on where their communications are going. We saw with the Theranos case, which was a private company, that their private investors were not being given, according to the government, information that they were required to receive, and they were misled about a number of things. So I think the same ideas apply to the extent you are seeking money or property from third parties. I think, you know, the ideas of being cognizant of red flags, the idea of being aware of the information that you're providing to others, I think is they apply. May not have the same process, may not have the same procedures, but the same concepts apply.
Well, we're anxious to get to the second part of the episode, but we did want to ask just quickly, because our audience knows we love to talk about Enron around here, have things improved since Enron and Sarbanes-Oxley, in your opinion?
I think from unquestionably so. I mean, I was very new to the SEC when cases like Enron and WorldCom and that whole, you know, companies that have now become somewhat household names all broke. And, you know, the punishments, the process improvements, the, I guess, greater resourcing of regulatory bodies like the SEC over financial reporting, over corporate disclosure, over internal controls, the greater focus that auditing firms have paid to this area, I think have paid dividends, because you don't see, or we haven't seen, I should say, the kind of magnitude of problems, at least among U.S. listed companies, that we once saw pretty regularly, really, if you think about the 90s and into the early 2000s, that were not uncommon. Doesn't mean that there aren't still misstatements. It doesn't mean there aren't still fraudulent schemes that go on. But I just think the magnitude and the frequency, as a broader proposition, have declined from my perspective as someone who was at the SEC for a long time.
Well, thanks for digging into that with us. We want to get to our second big question for David, but first let's take a quick commercial break. Everything you just heard David talk about is just the kind of thing that you probably want to talk about with your peers. And you can do that at Accelerate. Accelerate is the event where finance, audit, risk, and ESG pros can get together to talk about how they're going to lead the change to get ready for what's next. You can find out more about Accelerate, which will be happening in New York City, Chicago, and even online if you can't make it to New York City or Chicago. Find out more at workiva.com/accelerate. Register today, and Steve Soter will even be there.
Okay, we are back talking to David Peveler, current partner at Jones Day, former regional director at the SEC. David, we've been talking to a lot of people about the recently adopted climate disclosure rule from the SEC, which has been challenged, and then the SEC themselves have put a stay on the rule. What are challengers saying in their lawsuits, and then how do we expect that to impact what a court does and how a court's going to rule? Because it sounds like there's actually lawsuits on both sides. One saying that, hey, the SEC went too far. Other lawsuits saying the SEC didn't go far enough. Seems like the Eighth Circuit may have a tough job ahead of them.
I think that's a very fair summary. It is not going to be an easy thing to parse, because the SEC is getting punched from both sides, if you will. The challenges more or less fall into two buckets. Pretty broad buckets. One is a procedural bucket under the Administrative Procedures Act, which nobody wants to dig into the details of the APA. But essentially, an agency that passes rules has certain obligations in terms of providing notice, in terms of providing and making certain kinds of analyses, in terms of assessing the comments, the public comment that they get back. And that process is, set by statute, and a lot of rules by a lot of agencies are challenged under the APA. And the SEC is certainly no stranger to that. They have had, under Chair Gensler, almost continuous APA litigation, including some that has gone against the agency. Most recently, the share repurchase disclosure rule, which was supposed to have gone into effect, was struck down by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals on APA grounds. And so you're, I think, seeing from both sides of the challenges, both those who think that the SEC should not be making any rules in this area and those who think that the SEC's rules did not go far enough, both attacking the process by which the SEC went about making rules. And there's a lot of nuance there. There are issues of economics. There are issues of consideration of the SEC's statutory authority. There's considerations of how they've responded to different comments or different issues, whether their conclusions are supported by data. So those kinds of issues will get played out and assessed by the Court of Appeals on an APA basis. The other challenge, broad challenge, which is predominantly being brought by those who believe the SEC should not be making rules in this area, is a constitutional challenge. And again, it's very complicated, but the principal idea is what's called the major questions doctrine. And this is a relatively sparsely used Supreme Court and Court of Appeals doctrine that essentially says there are some questions that are so significant to the national economy or to society that that Congress essentially needs to make those decisions, not regulatory agencies under the executive branch through some sort of delegation or expansion of their own individual authority. And so the idea that's being presented is climate change or climate disclosures is such a matter of broad national importance and is so controversial and, you know, really needs a political solution, not a regulatory or an executive branch unilaterally making a determination and filling Congress's role, that the SEC has really exceeded its authority. This doctrine has been used, or at least presented, in a number of challenges to other agencies. The CFPB has been challenged on these grounds on some of their rulemaking. The SEC's own efforts to regulate the cryptocurrency industry have been challenged on this basis. So it is a theory that has been increasingly used. I think this particular Supreme Court is perceived to be more open to accepting those kinds of arguments. But that's really where the two challenges have fallen.
Do you think there's a reasonable argument to be made that I think the SEC has gone to some lengths to make, which is that, well, investors are looking for this information? We at Workiva actually have done a fairly large survey, and institutional investors have told us, hey, we actually prioritize investment in companies that include what we would call an integrated disclosure, sustainability with financial reporting. But I suppose the flip side of that would be, well, there's probably no end to the amount of information that an investor would love to have. Is there some boundary between information that an investor could reasonably expect it to have under what gets regulated by the SEC versus whatever other information that they might would want to have through whatever means they're able to get it?
And I think you've touched on exactly the issue, and that is, the SEC has passed a number of rules in the last two or three years requiring additional disclosure by public companies and on a variety of topics, you know, executive compensation, insider trading 10b5-1 plans, as I mentioned, the share repurchase disclosure. Cybersecurity disclosures are a requirement. And now you have these climate-related disclosures. And in each case, the SEC's rationale, or their base rationale for requiring this, is, well, it's material to investors. And I think the problem becomes, as you keep layering on topics, and maybe some of them are topics of the day, you know, they may be the hot button item of the day, then more and more becomes material. And essentially, if everything is material, then nothing is material. And you reach a point where that you can't really define what is and isn't of interest to the quote unquote reasonable investor. And I think that's one of the keys here is the standard that we apply in the United States for materiality is this hypothetical reasonable investor. What information would that hypothetical investor believe to be important to making an investment decision? And does the information significantly change the total mix of information available to that investor? And I think one of the risks that the SEC runs is some of this information, and I don't know if the full scope of the climate disclosure rule fits into this, but some of that information, at least arguably, is not material to the reasonable investor. It's maybe material to a particular group of investors or, a particular category of special interest investors, but that's not what the standard should be. And so I think there is a lot of concern that the SEC is continuing to layer on disclosures that don't really meet the standard for materiality. And I think that the problem is, or one of the related problems is that the SEC is at the same time, they're adding disclosures. They're not taking any away. I mean, they haven't said, okay, well, we're adding 50 pages of climate change and, cybersecurity and, executive compensation disclosure, but we're going to take away 50 pages of some other disclosure. And you're winding up with increasingly complicated, complex disclosure documents that for the average investor, is probably very challenging to comprehend.
Yeah, when you say average or reasonable investor, are we saying like an investor like me, or are we saying an investor like a pension fund or institutional investor?
You know, the idea is, at least as it's articulated legally, is the reasonable investor, someone who's reasonably knowledgeable about investments, reasonably knowledgeable about the industry that they're investing in, but not an expert. And so I would say it's somewhere between someone who's just, a casual investor and an expert in the industry or an expert in the financial industry is how I would define it.
But what if you are a public company at this point? What should you be doing? Do you put your plans on hold for preparing to comply with the SEC climate rule?
That is a really hard question to answer for one big reason. So as you mentioned, Steve, the SEC issued an order that stayed the effect of the climate change rule. And what they essentially said there is, there's all this litigation going on. We're just going to pull down all of the deadlines that are currently in place. But they did not say that if the litigation ends, we're going to reset those. They did say, however, in their briefing to the Eighth Circuit that they filed in response to requests by the other parties of that case for the court to issue a stay, a judicial stay. The SEC in their briefing said, when this litigation concludes, we will issue proposals for new deadlines. And that will go through the normal process that any rulemaking goes through. It'll be posted to the Federal Register. And so at least the agency has taken the position, and I think companies can rely on this, that if this litigation takes 2 years and it gets to an end and some parts of it are still standing, the SEC will take that, whatever's left standing, propose some new deadlines, and that will trigger, companies having to comply. But it's really hard to predict what that's going to look like, because if the whole thing survives, then there's a lot of work to be done, and it would behoove companies to at least start laying some groundwork for that process. But if only small pieces of it survive, then that might give you more breathing space to wait. The closest analog I can think of in recent times is for financial services industry participants who were dealing with the Department of Labor's fiduciary rule about 6 or 7 years ago. That was a rule that was extremely evolutionary to the financial services industry. and yet it was very controversial and ultimately was struck down in its entirety. But I was in-house with a financial services firm at the time, and we were taking a lot of effort to prepare for the potential of having to apply that rule, even though we thought it would probably be stricken down, at least in part. And so I think there's probably a middle ground of steps that companies can take. And many of them are already doing things with respect to their climate disclosures, in part because of other regulatory requirements, such as in California or in Europe. But I think there are some preliminary steps that at least a prudent company might take so that it's not caught completely flat-footed, depending on how this litigation all plays out.
It's probably a little bit tougher to prepare for compliance with an SEC climate rule than to decide at the last minute, like, what to make for dinner.
Yes, that certainly as written, that is definitely the case.
Is there anything else you wanted to add, David, before we get to our closing question of the day?
I think it's likely that regardless of what comes out of the Court of Appeals, there will be an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which has certainly not shown any hesitancy in trimming back the SEC in particular in its regulatory and administrative efforts. And so I think, you know, from the standpoint of where those who are challenging the rule as being beyond the agency's authority, I think they feel pretty good about their chances. And of course, one of the wild cards here that you know, no one can predict is the election in November is going to be significant to the outcome of this rule. Just by way of example, there were rules that the prior administration put in place at the SEC dealing with advice from shareholder advisory firms that was promptly undone and changed by the new administration. And you could certainly see a scenario where the SEC under a different administration, under a Trump administration, might decide they're not going to defend this rule, or they may take steps to pull it down. Because of the European, the expansiveness of the EU's rules and of the California rules, assuming they survive, the SEC can, and I think did, in my opinion, take a little bit softer approach than they had originally proposed, because they thought a lot of these companies, certainly the largest companies, are going to have to, they're going to have to apply the most stringent regulatory requirements that apply to them. And so if they're subject to EU requirements, they're going to have to disclose a lot of this stuff that's very controversial in our rule, and we can just pull that out because it's going to get disclosed anyway. So I think there was a little bit of pragmatism, I'm just guessing, by the agency on this front to try to defend or position the SEC rule for survival in the Court of Appeals. But I think we've got a long ways to go before anybody can safely predict what's going to be the ultimate requirement.
Yeah, how many months do you think it'll be before we have some clarity?
I really don't have a good answer to that. This is, you know, this is much more complicated, in my opinion, than, say, the share repurchase disclosure rule. And I believe that one played out over 6 or 7 months. And so I think this one will play out over a longer period. But that's just a guess. You know, it's just very hard to predict.
We can wrap up here with a closing question of the day, and we'll just back up a little bit, take a bigger picture view. David, is there anything that you would change about your time at the SEC?
You know, I think overall the answer is no. I would say, you know, the last few years I spent at the SEC were during the COVID era. And, you know, it was I always kind of described it as being like the Maytag repairman, because I would go into the office and it was an empty office very often because everybody was working from home. And so if I could change it, I would not have COVID, but that, you know, that's the only real thing. You know, it was a very rewarding an interesting and challenging job. So no, there's not much I would change about that experience.
See, Catherine, David's talking about his time at the SEC in terms of a career. I would talk about my time at the SEC is a handful of visits to the Washington, D.C. office. And what I would change is I would have given myself more time to get through security at that lobby area there. I've come to learn that's notoriously slow. No knock on the professionals there that are keeping the commission building and the staff safe, but you definitely need some time to get through that. So that's what I would change from my time.
Yeah, no doubt. At the SEC. No doubt.
Safety first.
Well, David, such a pleasure to have you again. Thank you for sharing, honestly, a lot of insights, and I think what have been on the minds of a lot of people. And again, not just with the SEC rule, but I think some of the other things that we talked about as well. Always a pleasure to chat with you, and we really appreciate you dropping by.
Thanks very much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Well, and thank you, dear listener, for surfing along with us. I'm Steve Soder. That was Catherine Tsai. This has been Off the Books, presented by Workiva. Please subscribe, leave a review, and tell your buddies if you liked the show. Now, if you're watching this on YouTube, we would love for you to drop us a note in the comments, tell us what you're thinking, or you are always welcome to drop us a line at offthebooks@workiva.com. Surf's up, and we'll see you on the next wave.